cast for the role of Heavy. Frail and temperamental, he fairly vibrated with nerves. Intended to unravel the mysteries surrounding the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, the briefings only further clouded them, the Boston Globe observed. The confusion indicated the pressure under which both Arena and Steele were working. Steele started off the first session by contradicting Arena's Sunday statement that his investigation had ended with an application for a complaint against Senator Kennedy. Police were still working on the case. One of the objects of the investigation is to determine if any additional charges will be placed against the senator, and to determine whether drinking or heavy drinking had occurred at the party Kennedy had attended prior to the accident. The senator could face charges of driving to endanger and driving under the influence of alcohol. These have all been considered and have not been ruled out, Steele said. But there is no material evidence now that the car was operated in such a manner. Pressed to amplify such provocative suggestions, Steele declined to say specifically that an investigation was being made into drinking. The investigation is continuing to determine whether other complaints should be sought, and the consumption of alcohol will be investigated. Since more than 9 hours had elapsed from the time of the accident until it was reported, it was unlikely evidence could be mustered to sustain a charge of drunk driving. I don't have, and probably will not have, any charges of a criminal sense, Steele said, promptly eliminating the charges he had just indicated were being considered. Steele's reference to other complaints caught Arena unprepared. That hadn't been discussed before the briefing, he said later. The most important requirement to prove drunk driving was a witness. We need someone who saw him operating in that manner. Although Arena had not seen Senator Kennedy until 9 full hours after the accident, nevertheless, he told reporters he had no evidence to indicate Senator Kennedy had been intoxicated at the time of the accident. When Kennedy reported to the police station, Arena went on, he walked steadily, he was clear of breath. I had no reason then to think he was drinking. Kennedy had undergone no sobriety tests on Saturday morning, Arena said. It would have been a violation of his constitutional rights even to ask him to take a breathalyzer test. Kennedy's crime began the moment he'd walked away from the scene. It was strictly an accident up to that point. To reporters at that first briefing, Arena insisted, "There's no proof of Senator Kennedy's faulty operation of the vehicle. I've got to repeat again and say emphatically, there is no negligence involved in this accident."
"Ah, come on, Chief!" a reporter called out.
Ted Kennedy drove a car off a bridge. That was evidence of negligence, wasn't it?
"What do you mean, oh, come on?" Arena shot back. "What's the matter with you guys?"
Steele stepped in. Police had measured the distance of the car from the bridge and were satisfied the senator had not been speeding at the time of the accident. Having received the evidence of the investigation, Steele was in agreement with Arena, he said. There is not, and probably will not be, any evidence there was negligence in the operation of the automobile. Arena's investigation was over. He would now limit himself, he said, to gathering evidence only in support of the misdemeanor charge, to make sure he had a strong enough case to secure a complaint against Senator Kennedy at next Monday's hearing. The hearing would be closed to the press. A transcript was not going to be made available to reporters, but they would be briefed on the proceedings. Steele told the reporters he felt it was unfortunate Arena had disclosed that Deputy Sheriff Christopher Look was scheduled to be called as a witness at the hearing. Look's testimony applied only to the time element of the accident, not as an indication of erratic driving by the operator of the car he'd seen at the intersection. Steele prevented Arena from revealing whether his investigation had disclosed the senator's whereabouts between the time of the accident and his report. "We have certain evidence on file in this case, which we will prosecute in the next few days as to that problem," Steele said. "I'm asking the chief not to comment on it. It's for Kennedy to show the judge where he was." Steele refused to comment on Kennedy's whereabouts himself. "I think it's unfair to this defendant, or any defendant, to comment." But in response to a later question, Steele absent-mindedly gave the game away. He said, We have no evidence as to his whereabouts. Asked if he thought Ted Kennedy had been in shock during the hours between the accident and the time it was reported, Arena replied, "Yes, but for how long?" Being in a state of shock was a legal excuse against the charge of leaving the scene. But we felt, in our case, that we had evidence of some part of that morning when we believed that the state of shock was not present. That is why we went forward with the charge we did. To determine how Kennedy had spent those hours, Arena had directed State Police Detective Lieutenant George Killen to interview the 12 or 14 people at the party, none of whom had been questioned by police, to establish the sequence of events before and after the accident. Arena had tried to question Ted Kennedy at the police station, but the senator said he wanted to talk to his lawyer first. I expected to hear from him, but I haven't heard from him yet. Arena hadn't thought it necessary to advise Ted Kennedy of his constitutional rights before taking his statement, he said. I just didn't think of giving him a Miranda warning. A senator. If Kennedy's attorneys attacked the statement on that ground, it might be thrown out. Once again, in the presence of the reporters, Steele cautioned Arena to say no more about the matter. Failure to give the Miranda warning might be a factor in his case, Steele said. But he declined to reveal if he'd have a case to prosecute should the statement be ruled inadmissible. Reporters at the briefing found absurd the suggestion that a U.S. senator, in the company of a former U.S. attorney, could deny knowing his constitutional rights and plead Miranda. In the Miranda case, the Supreme Court held that, while police were obligated to advise suspects of their rights, volunteered statements were not bound by the Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination, and were admissible in a trial. There was no requirement that a police officer stop any person from confessing to a crime. As it was, Arena had not asked Ted Kennedy a single question about the accident. Such inept waffling and trepidation provoked a tumultuous response from reporters. One blunt questioner asked whether Arena had been influenced to mishandle the case. Showing the strain of increasingly hostile questions, Arena resorted to pleading. "I've tried to cooperate with you fellows, and they're going to make a fool out of me in court because I tried to cooperate." But Arena recovered his good humor almost as soon as he lost it. He said, "About the only thing this case has done for me is help me to lose some weight." Arena had lost 15 pounds since Saturday. Still smarting from the going-over he'd received at the two-hour briefing, Arena said at the police station afterward, "What bothers me is that people think I'm not doing my job. But I'm a conscientious Christian. I'll give Senator Kennedy the same shake that I would give to John Smith." Arena was also being bombarded with letters and telegrams charging preferential treatment for Ted Kennedy, he said. "People can say what they want to, but we're in America where there is justice for all, which includes U.S. senators." Walter Steele was less tolerant about the contemptuous treatment he had suffered at the hands of reporters at the briefing. Steele was particularly outraged about the unavailability of the partygoers for questioning by police, a sore point reporters repeatedly brought up at the briefing. Arena had granted Senator Kennedy every consideration at the police station. While the senator was composing his accident report, the partygoers were being whisked off the island, Steele complained. "We played it straight and honest, and they left us holding the bag. They were gone before we knew what had happened." If Kennedy sources could plant misleading information in the press, so could Steele. Trying his hand at the technique for the first time, Steele leaked word that he expected to have statements by that weekend from the five men and five women who had attended the cookout with Senator Kennedy before the accident. The leak was attributed to Dukes County officials close to the investigation and said, "The state was prepared to take legal steps to compel the cooperation of the senator's friends if statements were not made voluntarily." But like his tough guy posturing at the briefing, Steele's threat had no legal force behind it. Arena confirmed later, "There was no way we could make those witnesses talk if they didn't want to." But Arena's repeated pleas to Dick McCarron about the availability of partygoers for questioning had paid off. McCarron told him, "We can get Jack Crimmins for you to talk to. Arrangements were being made for a meeting with the senator's chauffeur. McCarran had petitioned Ed Hanafy on the police chief's behalf to get Arena off the hook on this thing. He's got nobody to investigate the case but school teacher specials. To McCarran's knowledge, the only investigation of the accident had been conducted by the Registry of Motor Vehicles, and they weren't that much help. McCarran got Hanafy's permission for an official guest list to be made available to the police chief, provided to him by Angelique Boutsellis, Senator Kennedy's personal secretary. 4 days after the accident, Arena would finally know who had attended the now-famous party at Chappaquiddick. Chapter 23 Kennedy's flight from reporters at Hyannis Airport, and the 4 days of silence about the accident, had depleted press forbearance. Coverage was turning sour. Editorial demands for more information escalated in volume and intensity. Newsweek's cover story hit hard at Kennedy's stubborn silence. When the senator's closest associates are known to have been powerfully concerned over his indulgent drinking habits, his daredevil driving, and his ever-ready eye for a pretty face, the accident cried out for more explanation than the senator's bafflingly obscure police report had provided. Based in part on the memorandum filed by John Lindsay about an episode of public drunkenness on a plane returning from Alaska in April, the revelation shook the senator's office with seismic force. It was a signal that the senator's period of journalistic indulgence might be over. Calling Newsweek's charges untrue, Press Secretary Dick Drane sought a spokesman outside his office to refute them. The best he could do was Congressman Edward Boland of Springfield, Massachusetts. A close political ally and protege of Jack Kennedy campaign lieutenant Lawrence O'Brien, Boland denied Ted Kennedy was a hard drinker, had never seen him drunk in their travels together, and dismissed the girl-watching reference. But he couldn't supply the antidote to the poison of speculation about the goings-on at the party at Chappaquiddick. Only a guest could do that. For purposes of defusing that dynamite, Kennedy's office delegated Esther Newberg as spokesman for the Boiler Room Girls, none of whom had talked to reporters. The word has actually gone out that they are not to talk to anybody, a former member of Robert Kennedy's campaign said. An attractive, self-possessed young woman who held an administrative position with the Urban Institute in Washington, Newberg had gone to work for Robert Kennedy in 1967, joining the Boiler Room soon after he announced his candidacy for president. Newberg objected to the term Boiler Room Girls, employed to describe the group, she said. I am a professional. Mary Jo was a professional. We should be referred to as such. Returning to her apartment in Arlington, Virginia, after the funeral on Tuesday evening, Newberg granted a series of interviews over the next 4 days. She refused to discuss anything about the accident that might be prejudicial to the hearing Senator Kennedy faced on Monday, because there will be a trial, as I'm sure you understand. In contrast to the noisy brawl neighbor Foster Silva nearly called police about at 1:30 a.m., Newberg described the party as a quiet barbecue. It was a steak party. That's the kind of party it was. There was not a lot of drinking at that party, at most one or two drinks apiece. Coals had been lighted in the front yard, but everybody moved inside the cottage to eat because there are these little bugs on the island. Guests had reminisced about Robert Kennedy's presidential campaign, discussed the regatta race, and there was talk about the weather and other things that friends talk about when they get together. It was a fun party, Newberg said. No one was sitting around watching the clock, or keeping particular track of who was there or who wasn't at any given time. No one had specifically missed Senator Kennedy and Mary Jo Kopechne, or noticed what time they left the party, Newberg said. At some point, I guess we wondered where Mary Jo was and decided she had been lucky enough to make the ferry. We just assumed the senator was exhausted and had gone back to his hotel in Edgartown. No one expected him to stay. No one was worried or concerned. I suppose if there had been a telephone in the cottage, we would have called to check, but there wasn't. Newberg was not aware that the senator had returned to the cottage after the accident, or that someone outside asked for someone inside. Joe Gargan and Paul Markham had left the party sometime between 10:30 p.m. and 1 a.m.
But Newberg didn't know how long they were gone, what they'd been doing, or that anything was wrong. Having missed the last ferry to Edgartown, she and the others spent the night at the cottage, going to sleep around 12:30 a.m. Newberg said she had to guess at the time. Her Mickey Mouse watch, a topic of joking conversation at the party, wasn't working properly. Newberg learned about the accident the next morning, when she and the Lyons sisters were walking to the ferry landing, she said. On the way, we met Joe Gargan driving back toward the cottage. He stopped and told us something terrible had happened. He told us about the accident. He said Senator Kennedy was all right, but that Mary Jo had not been found. Gargan had telephoned her motel to say Mary Jo's body had been discovered in the accident car. She had drowned, although Senator Kennedy had tried to save her. The young women had left the island rather quickly, Newberg said. What else would you do? Mary Jo had known Ted Kennedy slightly before his brother's presidential campaign, but had gotten to know him better at headquarters, Newberg said. Ted Kennedy's office was 5 doors down from the boiler room. Often he would come in along with other people like Ted Sorensen to get information. The gathering at Chappaquiddick was the 4th boiler room reunion since Robert Kennedy's assassination. The first party had been given by Mrs. Edward Kennedy at Cape Cod the previous summer. The senator had attended a second party in Washington in January, but failed to show up at a third party 2 weeks ago. Newberg denied she had compared notes with others at the party to produce a consistent story of the accident, she said. Nobody's trying to hide anything. Two things were important to her. First, Mary Jo is dead and there isn't anything we can do about it. Second, I know inside that Senator Kennedy tried to save her. Susan Tannenbaum corroborated Newberg's version of the cookout as a decorous affair. There was some vodka at the party, but drinking was very minimal, she said. She hadn't thought it unusual for Ted Kennedy and Mary Jo to leave the party together. The senator often had conversations with the girls who had worked in his brother's boiler room. Tannenbaum assumed the senator was driving to the ferry so Mary Jo could return to her motel. She described Mary Jo as a serious, quiet girl. She wasn't a flippant type person. Tannenbaum reported for work as appointment secretary to New York Congressman Allard Lowenstein on Wednesday morning, but she didn't stay very long. Looking tired and tense, she left before noon, refusing to talk to reporters. Lowenstein's office issued a statement on her behalf. During the weekend, I lost a dear friend, Mary Jo Kopechne. My sympathies go out to her bereaved family and to Senator Edward Kennedy and his family. I have nothing further to say. But Tannenbaum would later complain about the intense interest in the press about the case. You can't begin to understand what it's been like. I place a tremendous value on the right of privacy, but suddenly I'm infamous. The real meaning of what you are and what you value remains intact inside yourself. But there you are, splashed all over the papers. Tannenbaum was especially incensed about speculation of improper conduct having occurred at the party at Chappaquiddick. She said, How would you feel if a reporter called your mother at 8 a.m. and asked whether she approved of her daughter's conduct in spending the night with a group of married men? Chapter 24. But efforts to destigmatize the party had come too late. Speculation and rumor had erupted into such a contagion of suspicion that even Arena was not immune. A message he found on his desk at the police station on Tuesday night to call Judge Clark from Brockton aroused suspicions where ordinarily there would have been none. I thought, hey, what's this? Is somebody going to say to me, Chief, would you mind going easy on the Kennedy accident case? Judge Clark turned out to be attorney Robert G. Clark, Jr., informing Arena that he and his son had been retained to represent Ted Kennedy in association with Dick McCarran. Clark asked for a meeting with Arena the next day, Wednesday. Arena was wary of the idea. He didn't know what Clark wanted. Would it be all right if Walter Steele attended the meeting, too? When Clark agreed to meet with the prosecutor, Arena suggested Steele's camp at Ocean Heights, several miles outside of Edgartown. Nothing clandestine was intended, Arena said. We just wanted to be able to hold the meeting without press coverage.
Clark arrived at Dick McCarran's law offices in a bungalow at the end of a lane off Edgartown's Main Street on Wednesday morning. A tall man, Clark had the compelling presence of a repertory actor. No ivory tower lawyer like Burke Marshall, he was a former Brockton shoe factory worker, with a strong record in hit-and-run and drunk driving cases. A tough, hard-nosed advocate of exceptional competence in dirty cases, a colleague observed. Clark had always been a police court kind of lawyer, with occasional splashes of heavy guys with big dough that people told, "Clark's the guy you should get. He's the best." And he was a good lawyer in all other respects, a very common-sense guy. Clark brought a portfolio of photographs of the accident scene, including aerial views taken by Boston Herald Traveler photographer Jimmy O'Callaghan, and delivered to his law office courtesy of editor-publisher Harold Clancy. Invaluable as the photographs were as an aid to comprehending the facts of the accident and preparing a defense, Clark nevertheless wanted to take a look at Dyke Bridge. Clark was conspicuously well-dressed in a three-piece suit and carrying a briefcase that virtually proclaimed his profession to the omnipresent reporters tracking McCarran's every move as Senator Kennedy's local attorney of record. McCarran loaned him a yellow slicker before driving to the landing to board the On Time. After inspecting the bridge and retracing the route to and from the Lawrence Cottage, Clark and McCarran left for a conference at the command post at the Kennedy compound. Hyannisport was under siege. Wealthy residents were furious at the inconvenience of the roadblock at Scudder Avenue, and the notoriety the Kennedy family had again inflicted upon their exclusive enclave. A mecca for tourists, the former summer White House of John Kennedy, was a privately owned residence of modest white clapboards behind a high stockade fence. To McCarran, the place was redolent of memories of John Kennedy greeting well-wishers at a rose-strewn fence during the 1960s summer of his presidential candidacy. The stockade had been added for security after his election to the White House. McCarran found a sense of embattlement inside, aides bustling about opening doors and running errands. He was impressed by the number and distinction of those brought together to defend a motor vehicles complaint in the district court. In command of the conference of lawyers in a formal dining room was Stephen Smith. A second conference was taking place upstairs, attended by Robert McNamara, Ted Sorensen, Milton Gwertzman, a Washington attorney who had written speeches for Ted Kennedy, and members of the senator's staff. Sorensen was moving from the upstairs conference to the dining room gathering material, it was apparent, for a statement of some kind. Edward Hanafy made it clear, "If I have anything to say about it, he'll never make that speech." The parallel meetings measured the schism that had developed between Kennedy's attorneys and his political people, McCarran observed. The lawyers wanted no statement made before Senator Kennedy went to trial. His advisers wanted to break silence for the sake of public relations and the senator's career. The situation was at a stalemate. McCarran was surprised it was happening at all. Hanafy wasn't the kind of lawyer who tolerated interference in the defense of a case. McCarran provided a factual, comprehensive description of the case of leaving the scene. Arena had sufficient evidence to get a complaint from Monday's hearing. The notion that Senator Kennedy had discharged his legal obligation to report the accident by telling Joe Gargan and Paul Markham about it didn't cover it at all, McCarran said. The statute says you had to make known your name, address, and the license plate number of your car. Presumably someone has to be there when the police arrive at the scene. At least that was my interpretation. A plea of nolo contendere wasn't in the cards either. Judge Boyle expected defendants to plead guilty or not guilty in his court. A nolo plea said, "Let's suggest everything you say is true. What are you going to do about it?" By accepting the plea, Boyle would be dismissing the case as unimportant. Nolo couldn't be applied to an accident where a fatality had occurred. McCarran said, "That's why it wasn't considered." A guilty plea would dispose of the case quickly, but the statute provided a sentence of 2 months to 2 years. McCarran pointed out, the law at that time had a mandatory 20 days in jail in all cases of leaving the scene after causing personal injury. Where a death had occurred in the accident, Boyle might feel obliged to impose the maximum 2-year sentence. Boyle had the reputation of being a defendant's judge in traffic cases. He had decried the injustice of arresting motor vehicle offenders after hearing a case in which a driver had been jailed for speeding. Boyle delivered a blistering lecture to Island Police for their callousness. He was critical of the double punishment drivers suffered in traffic cases, contending that the courts should decide loss of license and registration, not the Registry of Motor Vehicles, which did so without hearing all the facts. McCarran recommended pleading guilty and asking for the case to be continued without a finding for 6 months. In that procedure, a judge heard the evidence, but said, in effect, "I'm not going to find you guilty or not guilty. If you behave yourself, I'll dismiss the case. If not, I'll sentence you." McCarran gathered from the conference that Ted Kennedy had provided his attorneys with no additional information about the accident or the delay in reporting it. The senator was a client in absentia, a non-participant in the conference of lawyers, leaving to others, in particular Stephen Smith as his surrogate, the task of deciding his next move. Kennedy's remoteness alienated several of his advisors, who thought he wasn't leveling about the accident and was acting the hurt small boy and not the reasonable adult man in the crisis. Kennedy was reported to be so rattled and unsure of himself, he had, on reflex, turned over responsibility of decision-making to men, aides of his brothers, allowed them to grill him skeptically, openly dubious, as if he were an unreliable schoolboy. Kennedy himself would later recall the week after the accident as a time of great and searching speculation over the incidents surrounding the whole tragedy, many cross streams, people coming up and saying, "You ought to go to press conferences." My own feelings about the circumstances. I don't know how you describe the period other than enormously difficult and complex. Another onlooker, former Jack Kennedy confidant Richard Goodwin, saw it differently. Kennedy was obviously panicky still, obviously really shaken up, Goodwin recalled. And yet nobody else was really willing to make the kind of serious decisions a situation of this sort required. Goodwin composed an expanded version of the accident, covering as many of the inconsistencies in Kennedy's report as possible, to be attached to the operator's report of the accident the senator was required to file with the Registry of Motor Vehicles within 5 days of the accident. The idea was to make more information available to the press without holding a press conference or issuing a formal statement. Hanafy and Clark balked at the idea. Fearful of the impact should additional charges be brought, they wanted no additional disclosures made about the accident. Goodwin's version was scrapped in favor of an operator's report identical to the statement Kennedy had left in Arena's office, but with significant deletions. Gone was the reference to a passenger, Kennedy's rescue attempts, and the shock he had suffered after the accident. Gone was his request to be taken back to Edgartown, and with the realization of what had happened, having immediately contacted police. But the report did contain one new piece of information. Kennedy estimated his rate of speed prior to the accident at approximately 20 miles per hour. Chapter 25. At 6 o'clock, when wine and cheese were served to the lawyers at the strategy conference, McCarran decided he'd contributed all he could to the discussion and asked to be driven to Woods Hole, where he caught a ferry to Martha's Vineyard. McCarran wasn't going to take part in the meeting Clark had scheduled with Arena and Walter Steele for that same Wednesday night. Apprehensive at that prospect, Arena was equally concerned about Steele's growing agitation over the case. Still chafing over the beating he'd taken from reporters during Wednesday's two press briefings, Steele complained, "The nerve of these horses' asses, letting us handle the whole goddamn press while they pull up the drawbridge and don't say a goddamned word. In all my years in the district attorney's office, I never had such crummy treatment, and from people that are supposed to have some class." By day two of the briefings, 5 days after Mary Jo Kopechne had gone to her watery death, Steele had given up any pretense about a continuing investigation. "There is not a scintilla of evidence," he told reporters, "to point to any other charges. We are proceeding only on the charge of leaving the scene." And, he added, that investigation was closed, except for finishing touches. Arena was as anxious as was Steele to put a stop to the notion of other charges. To quell all the inferences and rumors, let us not forget that this is a driving case from start to finish, he said at the briefing. My investigation as an experienced police officer shows that this was a true accident, caused by natural conditions. No criminal negligence on Senator Kennedy's part was involved. Under reporter probing, Arena acknowledged that the lack of blood or breath tests had inevitably aroused speculation that the senator might have been drunk at the time of the accident. But, he added, there is not one iota of evidence that operating under the influence of liquor was involved. We don't, and probably will not, have a case of negligent driving in the criminal sense. I don't see how that can change. We're satisfied that the accident is an accident. What happened after the accident is the reason for the complaint. Arena told the reporters he was seeking telephone company records to determine whether Senator Kennedy had called anyone on Friday night or Saturday morning from the Lawrence Cottage. But newsmen who had dug deeper than Arena knew the remark only betrayed the poverty of information unearthed by his investigation. Had Arena inspected the cottage, he would have known there was no telephone there, only a jack for an extension to the telephone in a locked studio in the backyard. Defensive as Arena was, Steele went even further to protect himself from accusations of ineptness and timidity in prosecuting the case. Police had talked to some of the partygoers, he said, but Steele refused to reveal their names or any details of the conversations. Failure to report an accidental death to the proper authorities within a reasonable time was a misdemeanor punishable by a $100 fine. Yet Steele wasn't contemplating bringing charges against any of the senator's friends, reputed to have been given an account of the accident when Kennedy returned to the cottage. Surprised by Steele's fabrication, Arena tried to smooth it over. Lieutenant Killen, he said, was interviewing persons who had attended the party. Arena was promptly disputed by New York Post reporter Leonard Katz. Killen had denied he had been assigned the case. Arena admitted that he hadn't heard from Killen since his original request for help. In fact, he didn't know what Killen was doing. Well, I've talked to him, Katz said, and he's not doing anything. It's not his case. Reported to be as elusive as Senator Kennedy, Killen went public on Wednesday afternoon. It is not true that I have been assigned to this case. I have no intention of interviewing any witnesses. This investigation is being conducted by Chief Arena. All I know is, for all intents and purposes, the investigation is over. In view of Arena's statement to the press that there was no evidence of driving to endanger, and the finding of the medical examiner that the death was accidental, Killen said, I see no need of any investigation being made by the State Police Bureau. Privately, Killen scoffed at the notion, attributed to Dukes County officials close to the investigation, that those who had attended the party at Chappaquiddick could be compelled to give statements about the accident. This isn't Argentina, Killen said. Killen had to decline officially to assist Arena in questioning witnesses, D.A. Denise explained in New Bedford. A misunderstanding had occurred with regard to Killen's involvement in the investigation. That Arena had sought Killen's assistance directly should not be construed as action taken on the part of the district attorney's office. Unless specifically requested to do so by the police chief, this office will not step into the Senator Kennedy accident case, Denise said. He might take action after Monday's hearing, at which time I am sure there will be more clarification of the issue. More facts will be presented. Fairly driven once again from the press briefing, Arena only then began playing catch-up with reporters with a belated investigation. He brought Huck Look to Chappaquiddick to assist him in drawing a map of the intersection, where Look said he saw a car he believed to be the Kennedy car. Skeptical that the automobile that passed Dyke House about midnight had been involved in the accident, Arena nevertheless secured a statement from Mrs. Malm, resident of the cottage nearest the bridge. Her daughter had been reading under an open window in a bedroom facing the bridge, she said. Sometime between 11:15 p.m. and 11:45 p.m. on Saturday night, her daughter heard a car going fairly fast on Dyke Road, but nothing else. Nobody ever heard a car hit the water, Arena said later. It seems amazing if they were still up, they couldn't hear anything. Mrs. Malm had left a 25-watt light bulb burning all night at the back door of the house. The light was visible from Dyke Bridge. A light had also been left on in one of the children's bedrooms in a house across Dyke Road, occupied by the Reverend and Mrs. David Smith. Both were mystified Senator Kennedy had not sought their help after the accident, because of the house's proximity to Poca Pond. Back at the station, Arena received the report of an interrogation of Russell Peachy conducted by police officer George Searle, co-owner and manager of the Shiretown Inn. Peachy had refused to talk to reporters about Senator Kennedy's accommodation at his establishment during the weekend of the accident. The senator had checked in around 6 o'clock, but Peachy hadn't seen him again Friday night or Saturday, he said. But I believe Mrs. Stewart did. She was the desk clerk that morning. Arena was intrigued to learn Mrs. Stewart had talked to an apparently normal Senator Kennedy several hours before he had reported the accident. But Arena wasn't sure when Kennedy had appeared at the police station, variously reported to be 8 o'clock a.m. to 9:30 a.m. Saturday morning. Arena requested the negative of the photograph Harvey Ewing had taken of Ted Kennedy coming off the ferry around 9:45 a.m. as evidence. He said to Ewing, "You are probably nearer the time than I am. You may be a witness." The investigation was uncovering nothing but additional mysteries about the accident. No piece of the puzzle fit at all. One thing was clear. Senator Kennedy had not told the whole truth about the accident in his report. With his belated investigation going nowhere, Arena was to suffer another setback. A reporter called the police station to ask, "Did you know the registry has determined Ted Kennedy was at fault in the accident? They've just suspended his license because of negligence." Arena was stunned. "Red Kennedy was supposed to be cooperating on this thing," Arena said later, "and I had to hear about Ted's license being suspended from a reporter." Arena called the registry's office in Oak Bluffs. As required by law, in all cases of fatal motor accidents where there were no witnesses, the senator's license had been suspended until a statutory hearing could be held. If the hearing resulted in a finding of serious fault, the suspension would be changed to a revocation, which, by law, remained in effect for at least 6 months. The hearing couldn't be scheduled until Registrar McLaughlin received a full report from inspectors investigating the accident. Meanwhile, a standard form notice that his license was suspended for an indefinite period was sent to Edward M. Kennedy on Wednesday, July 23rd. He was ordered to surrender his license at once. "You must not again operate a motor vehicle until your license has been reinstated." The registry's action was a matter of interpretation, Arena told reporters at Wednesday afternoon's briefing. "I didn't recommend it, but I'm not opposed to it. It's just some more stuff to add to my woes." Walter Steele explained that the preliminary finding by the registry should not be construed as fault in the criminal sense. That Kennedy's license had been suspended, Steele added, would have no bearing on efforts to convict him of leaving the scene. Arena had the feeling, people were pulling the rug out from under me left and right, and there wasn't one son of a bitch who was cooperating. Even Walter Steele made me feel like I was alone in this thing. At the morning press briefing, somebody asked him, "Have you ruled out operating under the influence?" And Walter said no. And that really shook me up. I said to him afterward, "Walter, damn it! We don't have anything to hook him on for operating under." All these different things were putting me on the spot. Arena felt isolated even from other law enforcement agencies, he said. I got the feeling they were all avoiding me. Arena was surprised when Bill Carpenter sauntered into the police station. FBI resident agent on Cape Cod, Carpenter was a nice, easygoing guy, Arena said. Bill loved the vineyard. Despite his casual dress and relaxed manner, it was clear that Carpenter was working. Arena thought he'd been directed by Hoover, by way of somebody else, to snoop around. Walter Steele denied reports the FBI had expressed interest in the case. He was wrong. Again. At 5:35 p.m. on Wednesday, July 25th, Kitty Henley, senior secretary to the assistant to the director of the FBI, took down in shorthand a report telephoned by Special Agent James Handley of Boston. The car that was driven by Kennedy was found in the water near the beginning of the bridge. Skid marks were very short, indicating he was traveling at no great speed. The case of leaving the scene without reporting the accident will be based partly on his going by two houses near the scene to allegedly get back to his cottage, instead of stopping at the nearest house and summoning the authorities. The Registry of Motor Vehicles is consistent with the local police investigation in that there is no evidence of speed that could be called negligence. Chief Dominic J. Arena is of the opinion, and this is only an opinion, that Kennedy was not in shock for any 9 or 10 hours, and he desires to get the answers from Kennedy. The chief does not know how he could have been in shock that length of time. You have seen in the papers that the chief failed to advise Kennedy of his rights when Kennedy furnished the statement, partly because Markham, former U.S. attorney, and Gargan, who is a cousin of Kennedy, were present, and because the chief said he did not think of it at the time since Kennedy voluntarily appeared at the station. The chief said that now they have a witness who can show the Kennedy car was seen at 12:40 a.m. at the intersection near the bridge, which offsets the fact that Kennedy said he left the party with the victim at 11:15 p.m. The police have as yet no witnesses as to seeing Kennedy driving the car at any reckless speed prior to the accident or being under the influence. The chief suspects that Teddy Kennedy came from Chappaquiddick Island to Edgartown early in the morning, and not shortly after the accident, as he said in his statement. But the chief has no real good evidence to prove this. The chief suspects that the possibility exists that Kennedy may have been too loaded to report the matter immediately after the accident, but he has no evidence at all to support this. The common consensus on the island, the registry and the police, is that a complaint will be issued for Kennedy having left the scene of the accident. The police department is being deluged with letters from all over the world, 90% of which are against Kennedy and urging them to be thorough in this investigation so Kennedy can be convicted of the worst. Life magazine, according to the chief, is coming out with a statement pointing out that Kennedy has been living recklessly of late, probably since Bobby's death, as a protest against running for the presidency. In other words, he is being pushed to run for the presidency, whereas Teddy does not feel at this time he wants to run for it. Arena suffered total humiliation at Wednesday's afternoon press briefing, having to confirm that he had never made a direct request to the district attorney's office for assistance in the Kennedy accident. Killen had seen no need to become involved in the case, because the senator was only going to be prosecuted for a traffic misdemeanor. "This is the case and the only case I have." But for the first time since the accident, Arena complained about it. "This is my baby. Not a very nice baby, but my baby," he said. Showing the strain of 5 days of publicity and pressure, Arena revealed he was taking tranquilizers because of this thing. Chapter 26. Walter Steele was sufficiently calmed down by the time Judge Clark and his son arrived in Edgartown for their Wednesday night meeting. Clark came prepared to do business. Arena had filed a complaint application charging Senator Kennedy with leaving the scene of an accident after causing personal injury. Clark wanted him to know, there are technical defenses to this charge. However, Clark had to be guided by other considerations that transcend the usual criminal case, he said. He proposed Senator Kennedy admit to sufficient facts for a finding of guilty. The procedure included a plea of guilty and said, in effect, I don't want evidence of my wrongdoing presented as a case against me. The procedure required the consent of the prosecutor and the presiding judge. The idea was so obviously a whitewash. Even Steele, timorous as he was about prosecuting anything more serious than a misdemeanor in a fatal accident, objected. The judge won't go for it, he said, and neither do I. There are defenses to this charge, Clark reiterated, implying a not guilty plea could be in the offing. Steele wasn't fooled. We've got enough to hook him in court, he said. For the sake of argument, Clark said, if we pleaded guilty, what would you recommend to the judge? Steele would recommend a suspended sentence for any first offender on a leaving the scene complaint, he said. A suspended sentence would be fair to everybody. Clark wanted an assurance Judge Boyle would go along. You could never be sure about anything with Boyle, Steele said. You'll get a fair shake before this guy. He won't be influenced by the press, by Kennedy, or anybody else.
He goes strictly by the book.
Clark couldn't commit his client to anything so tentative. He wasn't a free agent. Another attorney was in charge of the case. Clark had to clear everything first. Stephen Smith and Ted Sorensen had the most to say about the senator's defense, he said.
They're calling the shots.
Clark had to return to Hyannisport before anything in the way of a plea could be decided. That a suspended sentence could be forthcoming, because Senator Kennedy was a first offender, wasn't as comforting a resolution of the case to Clark as it was to Arena and Steele, because he knew what they did not. Kennedy had never been involved in a hit-and-run accident before, but there was a record of serious traffic violations. Their nature formed a pattern of deliberate and repeated negligent operation. Particularly bothersome to Clark was a June 1958 conviction for reckless driving. On March 14, 1958, Deputy Sheriff Thomas Witten had been on routine highway patrol outside Charlottesville, Virginia, when an Oldsmobile convertible ran a red light, sped off, then cut its taillights to elude pursuit. A license check revealed the car belonged to Edward M. Kennedy, a 26-year-old law student attending the University of Virginia. Kennedy had in March 1957 been fined $15 for speeding. Witten was on patrol at the same intersection a week later, he testified. And here comes the same car. And to my surprise, he did exactly the same thing he did before. He raced through the same red light, cut his lights when he got to the corner, and made the right turn. Witten gave chase. He found the car in a driveway, apparently unoccupied. Looking inside, he discovered the driver stretched out on the front seat, hiding. Witten issued a ticket for reckless driving, racing with an officer to avoid arrest, operating a motor vehicle without an operator's license, mass registration. At his trial in Albemarle County Court, Kennedy testified that his taillights had a short circuit, a condition a garage mechanic confirmed finding a few days after Kennedy's arrest. Convicted of all charges, Kennedy paid a $35 fine. It had taken 3 months for his case to be heard, his attorneys able to win postponement after postponement. Court officials never filed the mandatory notice of the case in the public docket. Kennedy's name had not appeared on any arrest blotter. A local reporter spotted the case after discovering 5 warrants in Kennedy's name in a court cash drawer. 3 weeks after his trial, Kennedy was speeding again and still operating without a valid license. In December 1959, Kennedy was stopped again for running a red light and fined $10 and costs. In Witten's view, that boy had a heavy foot and a mental block against the color red. He was a careless, reckless driver who didn't seem to have any regard for speed limits or traffic ordinances. The offenses in Virginia had occurred on Ted Kennedy's Massachusetts driver's license, but neither the Registry of Motor Vehicles in Boston nor the Office of Probation in Cambridge had any record of the out-of-state convictions when Clark checked with that agency. Though clean on the record, there was always the chance the press might rediscover the 10-year-old history of Kennedy's reckless driving and jeopardize his first offender status in Edgartown Court, should a plea of guilty be made. The technical defenses Clark threatened Arena and Steele with were the vagueness of the statute as it pertained to operating a one-car accident, the constitutional issue of self-incrimination through the statement Kennedy left with Edgartown police, and a medical defense of shock. But the body of documentation gathered from the senator's various examinations and treatment had undercut the medical argument. Instead, that body of evidence indicated Kennedy had not been seriously injured in the accident, but had suffered a slight concussion, a bump on the head, a scratch behind the ear, and a stiff neck. No medical evidence supported a diagnosis of shock. Nor did Kennedy's behavior at the Shiretown Inn the next morning reflect the condition. According to Arena, the senator had looked depressed but physically okay at the police station. A not guilty plea required a trial open to the press and public, cross-examination of the senator, and the presentation of evidence against him. All those who had attended the party could be subpoenaed and made to testify. Deputy Sheriff Christopher Look was scheduled to be a witness, to enter into evidence the controversial question of the time the accident had taken place. Luke's observations that the driver appeared lost and confused could provoke inferences of impairment, such as drunk driving, although neither Steele nor Arena had drawn that conclusion from Luke's information. Luke's story disturbed other lawyers, McCarran said. They were upset about it. The time difference was baffling to everybody. McCarran talked to Luke himself, and believed he had seen the car an hour and a half after Ted Kennedy said the accident happened. But McCarran wasn't concerned about the discrepancy. I didn't think it would take that much time for Senator Kennedy to conform his story on the question of time with Huck Luke's. Despite the peril he could be placed in by his traffic record, Senator Kennedy might be wiser to take his chances with a guilty plea to leaving the scene, rather than expose himself to more serious charges of driving to endanger and possibly manslaughter, as a result of more information coming out of a trial to defend a misdemeanor. As to manslaughter, the rule in Massachusetts was clear. Any person who wantonly, or in a reckless or grossly negligent manner, did that which resulted in the death of a human being, was guilty of manslaughter, although he did not contemplate such a result. Negligence in exposing another to injury by doing an act supplied all the intention the law required to make a defendant responsible for the consequences. A further manslaughter charge possibly had developed from John Farrar, the Edgartown Fire Department scuba diver. In a number of interviews, Farrar repeatedly expressed the opinion that Mary Jo Kopechne might have lived for some time underwater by breathing a bubble of trapped air, and that she could have been saved if rescue personnel had been promptly called to the scene of the accident. As a result of the famous Coconut Grove nightclub fire in Boston in 1942, the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court had broadened wanton and reckless conduct to consist of an intentional failure to take such care in disregard of the probable harmful consequences. In upholding the guilty verdict of manslaughter brought against Barnett Wolanski, owner of the nightclub, for failing to keep his establishment safe for patrons, the court had ruled failure to do an act was as culpable as driving an automobile or accidentally discharging a firearm. Grave danger to others must have been apparent, and the defendant must have chosen to run the risk rather than alter his conduct, so as to avoid the act or omission which caused the harm. Even a defendant, so stupid or heedless not to have recognized the danger, could not escape the imputation of wanton or reckless conduct in his dangerous act or omission. If Senator Kennedy's failure to secure rescue assistance had contributed to the death of Mary Jo Kopechne, his omission to act was negligent. He was liable for prosecution under the Wolanski decision. That was, in fact, the major legal prop under which District Attorney Edmund Denise had successfully prosecuted for involuntary manslaughter in 1967, a Christian Scientist for failing to provide medical treatment for a child who had died of pneumonia. Senator Kennedy confronted a legal dilemma. A not guilty plea required a trial, which could uncover damaging evidence against him. A guilty plea avoided a public inquisition and further revelations of wrongdoing, but made him liable to a possible jail term, and provided an admission on the record that was one element required to prove manslaughter, should that charge be subsequently brought against him under Wolanski. If the hardest decision was what plea to make, Kennedy also faced the increasingly urgent need for a statement of explanation about the accident. Kennedy's dependence upon speechwriters was legendary. In the preparation of a speech, most politicians briefed their writers before a draft was written. But Kennedy's writers completed a draft, then entered into discussion, during the course of which he was unusually receptive to other people's suggestions. Kennedy had assigned others to compose the famous eulogy delivered at his brother Robert's funeral. One of the speechwriters felt pretty funny about it, because how could we know what he felt about his brother? He just said, write something on the theme of love. I thought maybe that was one speech he shouldn't have asked us to write. But composing any explanation of the senator's accident at Chappaquiddick required a legal and verbal dexterity to explain away the 10 hours it had taken for authorities to be notified. That task was assigned to Ted Sorensen, the literary light of the Kennedy White House. honored 4 days before the accident by the University of Nebraska as a graduate having influenced national affairs and life more than any other living Nebraskan. Sorensen arrived at the compound full of brooding reproach for what Ted's mischief was going to do to the legacy. Sorensen could hardly conceal his distaste for the whole affair. When Senator Kennedy called upon him to give legal counsel, "I responded to the call," Sorensen said. But he thought Kennedy's action at the time of pressure was indefensible. The presence of a girl in his car and liquor at the party fanned the flames of ugly suspicion and wild speculation about his motivations for not going to the police immediately. Sorensen found it difficult to suspend my own moral judgments in working on a matter of that kind, and I therefore was insistent that whatever he said to the public, it did not contain misstatements of facts. Sorensen consulted Gargan about certain things he was not aware of, that he wanted to make certain about. Gargan confirmed the rescue efforts he and Paul Markham had undertaken at Dyke Bridge, his urging that the accident be reported, and Ted Kennedy's impulsive dive into the Edgartown Ferry Channel. Gargan said nothing about the alternative plan for reporting the accident Kennedy had proposed, or Kennedy's suggestion that it was Mary Jo Kopechne who drove the accident car. As the crisis passed into a fifth day of silence, editorial and political heat intensified. A leading Democrat, critical of Kennedy's behavior since the accident, suggested, "He can't let this thing deteriorate. I can't help but think he's been badly hurt. He may be able to come back if he's got some answers." Reported under sedation, still suffering from the traumatic shock of not rescuing Mary Jo Kopechne, a girl he hardly knew, from the car, Kennedy had made no decision to delegate a spokesman with authority to make statements or answer questions. It was unlikely the senator would reveal more information about the accident before his court appearance, an aide said. Any comment might have a prejudicial effect on the hearing scheduled for Monday. But the change in editorial winds brought increasingly strident demands for complete disclosure of the accident. Kennedy's report to Edgartown police was woefully inadequate. Worse, there are good reasons to doubt that it is even accurate, the Washington Post charged. If, the Post said, Kennedy remained silent, they could expect not only honest doubts to remain about his post-accident behavior, but also the bitter whispering campaign that has already begun. The talk will go on amplified about the initial timidity of the police, and how the Kennedys managed that. About the drinking and the calls to lawyers and the various damaging versions of what actually transpired that night. Saying nothing would do Kennedy grave harm, which is why he would be better advised to get the politics out of it and clear up the record of this tragic affair. To end speculation and rumor that was vilifying the senator's reputation and undermining public confidence in our law enforcement system, the Boston Record-American suggested it was appropriate and essential in the interests of justice that an inquest be held into the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Chapter 27. The growing clamor for more information found echo when, for the first time, Dukes County Medical Examiner Robert Nevin made a public statement that the circumstances attending the death of Mary Jo Kopechne warranted an autopsy. "We don't know if the girl died of a heart attack, a stroke, or from drowning," he said. Nevin said he would have asked the state police to send a pathologist to Edgartown. "I wouldn't have let that autopsy go. I would have gone to Washington if I had to. It wasn't too late when Dr. Mills learned the entire story around 2:30 a.m. The corpse had been embalmed. The presence of formalin couldn't change the picture. Mills had performed his function of medical examiner by satisfying himself there was no evidence of foul play in the death, Nevin said. But the point is that there are so many nasty questions. It would have been a kindness to Senator Kennedy to have an autopsy, so that all the nasty questions could be answered. An autopsy could still be possible, Nevin said. The order could come from the district attorney. Denise passed the buck. He would have preferred an autopsy be performed, he said, but it was up to Dr. Mills whether to order one or not. District attorneys rarely became involved in automobile accident cases, Denise said. In my 11 years as a district attorney, we've never investigated a motor vehicle's accident. Arena had reported the accident to him, and then for some reason bypassed me and contacted